Very few politicians in Sacramento have an incentive to say anything about the overstaffing and the inefficiencies in our government. That's what a businessman does. You know, I look for inefficiencies all throughout my business whenever I can, because the bottom line is it's my money that's being wasted. Well, that's the way I'm going to operate in government here, because there's a lot of money being wasted and the taxpayers are paying for it.
Businessman and Republican candidate for governor John Cox. He's running third or second, depending on which poll you read, and he's staking out pro-business and pro-Trump positions in hopes of making the top two runoff in September. John Cox is here to talk about his campaign and his plans for California. But we're going to begin the show overseas in Israel. The U.S. opened its new embassy in Jerusalem today, and at the ceremony, the delegation talked peace.
While the challenges to peace are numerous, I have personally seen that the determination of the leaders in the region and throughout the world remains steadfast. They have seen too much pain, sorrow, and wasted opportunity, and they think it's time to try something better.
That's Jared Kushner, who's been tasked with coming up with a peace plan. But as he was speaking, it was anything but peaceful in Gaza. Israeli forces killed more than 50 Palestinians and wounded more than 2,400. The White House blamed Hamas for instigating the violence. There was more violence last week after the U.S. pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. Israel and Iran traded rocket attacks into and out of Syria. So what does this mean for Kushner's stated goal, peace in the Middle East? To help us answer that, I'm joined now by Aaron David Miller, a longtime Middle East peace negotiator. He's now at the Wilson Center. Welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, today is the 70th anniversary of Israel's independence. Yesterday was Israel's Jerusalem Day, so I assume the ceremony today was no coincidence. What is the U.S. saying with this move about its commitment to a two-state solution, do you think?
Well, I would argue that this represents, and again, I've worked for Republicans and Democrats and voted for Republicans and Democrats. It's not a partisan comment. But like so many things, it seems to me, in this administration, you have the triumph of domestic politics. And persona over the national interests, whether it was withdrawal from Trans-Pacific Partnership, climate change, travel bans, or the recent withdrawal from the highly flawed yet clearly still functional Iran nuclear deal. Like all of those, Mr. Trump, I think, was determined to separate himself from his predecessor and to become the un-Obama, particularly on the Israel issue, placate and satisfy a domestic political base, and essentially deliver on campaign promises that he's made. I would argue this was done unmoored and untethered from most foreign policy considerations, certainly from any consideration of what sort of impact it would have on the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, which I might add were more or less dead in the water even before Mr. Trump got to Washington.
Mm. So you're saying this was mainly for his evangelical Christian base than for anyone
else?
Well,
not just evangelical base, but conservatives, pro-Israeli community. And again, I think he has a preternatural determination to become the un-Obama and to separate himself from the Obama administration, particularly in the Israel issue. You know, the soap opera and ups and downs of the Benjamin Netanyahu-Barack Obama relationship for 8 years basically created a kind of a dysfunctional relationship between the two countries, even though on many issues they would continue to cooperate. I think Mr. Trump, for any number of reasons, was determined to change that.
Well, apparently Jared Kushner is coming up with, or he says he's coming up with, some kind of peace plan. Have you seen any evidence of that?
You know, the first time I met Mr. Kushner, I said to him, I wish my father-in-law had as much confidence in me as your father-in-law appears to have in you, because he's given you Mission Impossible. And I would argue what happened today, even though it is my firm conviction that the U.S. Embassy belongs in West Jerusalem, there's no question about that, but in the context of a negotiated solution, or at least in the context of a commitment to create a U.S. presence embassy in East Jerusalem that would represent American interests to the Palestinian capital of a putative Palestinian state. I think the only conceivable logic of what they've done is to borrow a sort of tactic from one of my former bosses, James Baker, who would have argued that what is required is to create a good deal of honey for one party in expectation that at some point you're going to ask that party to swallow some vinegar. Mm. And the real question is, having preternaturally become the most pro-Israeli president in the history of the world, the question is Mr. Trump going to ask Mr. Netanyahu to make the kinds of tough choices now that he has his back and has demonstrated it has gone somewhere where no other American president has ever gone before, actually opening an embassy in West Jerusalem. Is he going to ask Mr. Netanyahu to make the kinds of choices on the core issues, Jerusalem, border, security, refugees, that have to be made if, in essence, you're ever going to get to something akin to a negotiation that could lead to two states?
And settlements, too, West Bank, in the West Bank.
Yeah, all the six issues I identified, including recognition of Israel as the nation state of the Jews and end of claims and conflict, all of those are subordinated. All other issues, water settlement activity, are subordinated to one of those six issues, in this case, borders. So I don't know the answer to that question. I've had a couple of conversations with Mr. Kushner. I don't know the answer to that question. I do believe, however, that they will present something, and what I think they're going to present is going to be quite detailed.
Well, what could they present to Israel that Israel would concede on?
Well, it depends what issue. I mean, the Palestinian narrative is clear, and the Palestinians are going to have to come off of some of it if a negotiation is going to succeed. But the basic parameters of the Palestinian narrative are this: capital in East Jerusalem, and not a phony or a toy capital, which gives the Palestinians control over a neighborhood or two in East Jerusalem, and then some symbolic capital on the West Bank, like Abu Dis, something akin to the 67 borders, which the Israelis regard, Abba Eban, a noted Israeli dove, referred to as the Auschwitz borders. You're going to have to get something. June 67 borders minus X. And the X is going to be how much territory the Israelis feel they need to keep for security and demographic reasons. Is it 1%, 2%, 3%, 5%? At Camp David, which I was one of the 12 Americans there, which was the last serious effort to negotiate a solution to this problem, the X factor was 8%. The Israelis wanted 8% of the West Bank, and they were prepared somehow to compensate the Palestinians with swaps of equal size and value. So at some point, that's another critical decision that's going to have to be made. Refugees, very hard. There simply can't be unlimited return of Palestinian refugees into the state of Israel, for sure. But you're going to have unlimited return, presumably, to a Palestinian state. So I think the problem here is that on every single issue, without exception, particularly Jerusalem, the gaps that now separate Mr. Netanyahu's position from Mr. Abbas's are Grand Canyon-like, which doesn't bode well, frankly, for anybody's peace plan.
Right. And then by blaming Hamas for today's violence and by putting the embassy in Jerusalem and having this big ceremony, isn't the United States, in effect, saying, Israel, we're completely on your side, we have your back, Netanyahu, do what you like?
Well, I think if you looked at the first year plus of the Trump administration, you'd have to conclude that they have taken positions that are incredibly close to the Israelis down the line. There's no question about that. But I guess I would ask the same question I asked earlier. Is this a negotiating tactic designed to create a certain corner for Mr. Netanyahu so that he simply cannot use the justification that this is a hostile administration to get him to swallow the vinegar? I mean, it's a legitimate negotiating tactic. I'm just not persuaded that this administration has the sensibilities to understand that this is a conflict that that involves two competing justices, that it is not one hand clapping, that Israeli needs are going to have to be met, that Palestinian needs are going to have to be met. I just don't know if that piece of software has made it into the calculations of the Trump administration. One additional point. Plus, this may be a check-the-box campaign commitment issue. Right now, this president is looking at one foreign policy objective, and that is on June 12th, this summit, which is remarkable that it's even being held. A lot of it has to do with the Chinese and
you're talking about North Korea.
President Moon of South Korea. This summit offers Mr. Trump, and again, it's not a partisan comment. I voted for Republicans and Democrats and worked for them too. But this summit, if it works, and a serious process of denuclearization over time actually gains traction, this could get Mr. Trump reframe his foreign policy presidency, get him in the history books, and yes, get him a Nobel.
Wow. Okay. Aaron David Miller, we'll have to leave it there at the Wilson Center. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates for California governor. Today, Republican John Cox. He's here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We continue our series of interviews with the top contenders in the race to be California's next governor now. The primary is June 5th. The top two vote getters will advance to the November general election. And today we have Republican candidate John Cox, businessman and an accountant. John Cox joins me now. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Madeline. It's nice to be with you.
Great for you to come into the studio. Thanks for being here.
So
people are now just tuning in, really paying attention now to the governor's race. And probably a lot of our listeners have no idea who you are. Who are you?
I'm a businessman. I grew up in Chicago, moved to California about 10 years ago following the rest of my family. My mom was a Chicago public school teacher. She retired to Fresno in 1980. My grandparents actually moved here in 1968, basically all three of their daughters ended up living in California most of their lives, and I finally moved out here to join the rest of my family. And
what took you so long?
I had to save up enough money to buy a house out here. It's pretty expensive. That's one of the reasons I'm running, Madeline.
Well, I was going to ask you that as my second question. Why do you think, with only 10 years in the state under your belt, do you think you're qualified to run for the state's highest office?
Well, I've been following California for much longer than that. But the big issue here is the unaffordability of the state. The people of the state cannot afford their house. They can't afford their gasoline, their water, their electricity. The state is being mismanaged in an epic fashion by the people in charge. They're politicians. They basically turn over government to the special interest in Sacramento. I want to do something about that. I've been managing businesses my whole life. I started my own business when I was 24 years old with nothing, basically, and I built it into a $200 million business that is very successful.
And what is that business?
Real estate. Mm-hmm. I build and manage apartments. And do a very good job with that. Quality, efficiency. I don't waste money.
You have an expert in real estate. How is it that we're going to get people, developers, to build millions more units every year?
We've got a streamlined regulation. I've talked to so many builders here who tell me that the cost of regulation, the litigation, the impact fees, the delay it takes 8 to 10 years to get a project approved. Very few people want to do it. And I'm in the apartment business. I build apartments in Indiana for $80,000 a unit. They rent their wonderful apartments for $800 to $1,000 a month, brand new ones.
Well, that is Indiana, so
it's
cheaper to build out there.
It's less expensive to buy land. The land is less expensive. I'll grant you that. But the building costs are not that much less expensive. It's the except for the cost of government. And that's my point. I mean, in California, the cost to build is driven up by government regulation and red tape and approvals and environmental lawsuits and a whole host of things
let's talk about the environmental issue. You are saying that you want to get rid of the state's environmental law, CEQA.
I want to get rid of it and replace it with something that works a lot better. I certainly want to benefit the environment. I certainly want clean air. I first came to California in 1968, and I could barely see skyscrapers in Los Angeles because of the smog. We obviously have done a lot to clean the air, and I think we need to do a lot more. But we got to balance the needs of the environment, which of course we need to keep clean, with allowing people to live and afford their lifestyle. I mean, it does no good if people are just struck with a tremendous cost in order to try to live in the state.
But aside from the regulations and the red tape that you describe that make it difficult to build a lot quickly. There are also local considerations, and a lot of localities simply don't want to build more in within their boundaries. So how would you get beyond local opposition to say, look, you know, this is a statewide problem. We need a lot more housing to drive down the costs, and you've got to build more housing.
Well, I think we do. And of course, there was a bill that was introduced that would have created statewide exemptions for people to build. And I think that's wrong, too. I think what we could do is exercise leadership. You know, I'm in the real estate business, and when I'm the governor of this state, I'll exercise leadership to try to incentivize local authorities to produce more housing.
And how would you do that?
Well, I'm a Jack Kemp Republican. I believe in incentives. I think incentives work. And so what I would try to do is work with experts to incentivize, create areas and work with the local authorities to create areas where certain kinds of housing would be built, and maybe work with building transportation projects that could help serve those properties as well. Again, I don't want to see things forced by state government. I don't want to see a top-down, one-size-fits-all policy. I certainly want local control. But I think there can be a lot of things that are done at the leadership level, if you will, that would allow more building to be done and less expensively. I mean, I don't think we can keep escalating the cost for people. I mean, people are telling me they're working two and three jobs to try to afford a house in the state. It's wreaking havoc with business budgets as well as government budgets. And think about it. We're paying people far bigger salaries to live in California because the cost of housing is so high. And that's driving up taxes. It's driving up the cost of doing business, which is why a lot of businesses are leaving the state. This state cannot be successful.
This state is also the world's fifth largest economy.
And
there are a lot of businesses who like it just fine here. Google, Facebook, Apple, lots of huge multinational corporations located right here in California. So how can you say that businesses are fleeing the state?
Well, just because you just named three that are obviously some of the most successful companies in the world. But there's a lot of smaller, much smaller businesses that are not having a go of it and are leaving the state.
Let's talk about immigration. And you are a supporter of the president's plan to build a border wall, correct?
Yeah. It's all about security, Madeline. I mean, the first role of government is to protect the people. And I've been down the border. There are people, I have friends in Tucson who tell me that guns and drug traffickers and human traffickers are still coming across the border.
But even it's John Kelly, the president's chief of staff, has said that most people who come across the border, quote unquote, illegally, are not lawbreakers in any other way.
No,
that
thank
they're
God.
Just looking for a better life. They're
they
looking
are.
To
yeah.
make a living.
Yeah, they are. But that doesn't vitiate the idea that even a few people who come across to do bad things or to carry guns or to carry drugs is a bad thing. Just because a large percentage of them are really good people doesn't mean that we shouldn't guard ourselves against people who are looking to do us harm. I tell you what, MS-13, the gang, is a real threat. And there's more and more statistics that they've permeated a lot of our big cities and are wrecking havoc with a lot of families who want to live in peace.
Well, they're a very big threat to people who are fleeing them from El Salvador and trying to come here and try to actually live. So,
I agree. But, you know, that's El Salvador's problem. I mean, we don't do them any favors by taking – are we going to empty out those countries in Central America and house them all here? I think those people ought to get their government in order and deal with their problems themselves.
However, crime rates, although they've edged up recently, they're still dramatically lower than they were in the 80s.
Well, the economy is good. I mean, you know, the crime rate goes down when the economy is recovering and people have jobs.
Well, the crime rate was pretty low during the recession, the 2008-2009 recession.
Not so much. But I tell you what, in Los Angeles,
violent crime was.
In Los Angeles now, the crime rate has gone up substantially. And, you know, you can tell that to the family of Anthony Mealy, who was sitting in a restaurant in Ventura, holding his 5-year-old daughter on his lap when a homeless person came up and sliced his neck and killed him. One murder like that is horrendous.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it's horrendous, though, and we're doing no favors to people.
But what does that have to do with immigration?
Well, it doesn't, but it's a crime. You and I talked about crime. And I think people are still worried about crime in their communities. And if you talk about crime in San Francisco, a significant number of break-ins of cars occurring on the streets.
I guess, no, I was actually referring to the border wall, and then you're saying that that would prevent crime. And
we shifted to talking about crime in general. But, you know, listen, again, the border wall is all about securing us from drugs and guns and, you know, MS-13 and human trafficking. And again, even if it's a small number, I think the job of government is to protect us. So I don't see why a border wall is all a bad idea. You know, remember, we have a totally unprotected border with Canada, pretty much, and we don't worry about it too much.
There's no call for a wall up there. Do you think there should be?
No, because Canada is a pretty well-run nation that has control of its own population. That's not the case in Mexico. There were 28,000 murders in Mexico last year. You apply that to the U.S. with our population, you're talking about almost 100,000 murders. Can you imagine if we had 100,000 murders in this country? People would be up in arms. No. We have a problem to our southern border because we have a government down in that country that is mismanaging its people and is not dealing with the criminal conspiracies and the drug trade down there. And I don't want to see that move to America.
Okay. Your big issue also seems to be repealing the gas tax.
Is
that correct?
It is. The cost of living here is outrageous, Madeline.
Okay. And so that might be on the ballot in November.
It will be on the ballot. We collected 1 million signatures almost. And, you know, people were chasing the signature gatherers to sign this thing. You know why the problem? Because Caltrans spends 4 times what Texas does to build a mile of road. Think about that for a second.
And is this because of environmental regulations?
No, it's because of corruption. It's because of waste. It's because very few politicians in Sacramento have an incentive to say anything about the overstaffing and the inefficiencies in our government. That's what a businessman does. You know, I look for inefficiencies all throughout my business whenever I can because the bottom line is it's my money that's being wasted. Well, that's the way I'm going to operate in government here because there's a lot of money being wasted and the taxpayers are paying for it.
Are you saying that Jerry Brown has mismanaged the economy?
Absolutely.
There was an $8 billion surplus.
Well, just because we're generating a lot of revenue doesn't mean he's not wasting money and spending it excessively. We have increased education spending 80%, Madeline, in the last 7 years. We're now spending $76 billion a year on education. And the results, the performance, has been miserable. We are now something like 48th in the country in terms of educational scores. Los Angeles last year, and I got this from a Democratic group, issued more suspensions than diplomas. We are failing the least vulnerable among us. I want to see teachers get paid. I want to see teachers paid like rock stars and baseball players based on how well they do.
Mm-hmm.
Merit.
I think the 48th figure is per pupil spending. So California
No, these are educational attainment results.
But you know, California is near the bottom. It might be even 49th in per pupil spending.
I've looked at that, by the way, and you have to look at the total dollars that are being spent. There's a lot of games that are played with that because money comes from the state and also money comes from local tax revenue. So I've seen other studies that show that California is pretty much up there near the top in terms of pure pupil spending.
Well, regardless, the head of the LAUSD here, this is the nation's second largest school district, says he needs more money and he's going to go to Sacramento.
They always need more money.
Would you give him more money?
The issue is how you're spending the money. I want to cut administrative costs. I want to get the money into the classroom. I want to get it to the teachers. I want to get rid of tenure as well. I don't have tenure in my business. I want to be able to get rid of teachers that aren't performing.
You have come out in favor of keeping Proposition 13, and you've said in your ads that you want the tax rates that people have, their property tax rates, to be portable. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
That if you sold your house and moved to another house, you would keep the same property tax?
Yeah, and my opponents are all for emasculating Prop 13. They want to do away with it, obviously, because they want revenue. You know, the revenue.
But how would that work? How would that work in terms of keeping state revenue afloat?
The first thing it would do is we'd have more velocity of homes. A lot of people are staying in their homes There is an exemption over 55, but there's a lot of people under 55 who are staying in their homes because they can't afford to sell, because if they sell and buy another home, they're going to get hit with a huge property tax bill. And, of course, that distorts the real estate market and keeps prices higher than they ordinarily should be. So I think that's the issue that I was arriving at there. But, you know, Madeline, this state doesn't have a revenue problem. It has a spending problem. The revenue of the state under Jerry Brown has gone from $80 billion a year to $140 billion in the general fund. That's a huge increase. You're talking about a 70-80% increase in the revenue of the state in just the last 7 years. Thank God we have an economy that's doing that, but that's more money out of the pockets of hardworking Californians that could be in their pockets to save for retirement and to save for college education and doing a lot of other things. And what has Jerry Brown and the legislature done? They've spent that money. They've got boondoggle after boondoggle, waste after waste. This state, Madeline, last year spent $6 billion on overtime for state employees. Now, in my business, I make sure people don't work overtime because that's time and a half. That's double time. That's paying them more than you bargain for. That's waste.
Do you believe in paid family leave?
I think if a business can afford to pay its employees paid family leave, I'm all for it.
Do you think there should be a state law mandating paid
family
leave?
No, I think we have way too many mandates. I think businesses should be allowed to decide that they want to keep employees. I pay my employees. I give them a certain amount of paid leave.
How much?
I don't recall now, but it's some number of weeks.
Both men and women?
Yes.
Do you believe in human-caused climate change?
I believe that the climate's changing. I believe that humans probably have some impact on it. I'm not at all convinced that it's all caused by humans. I'm not at all convinced that it is something that is not beneficial. In some areas, it may well be beneficial. What I think we ought to do is clean the air. I think we ought to clean the water. I think we ought to do it in a way that weighs the benefits versus the risks.
And but how do you do that without regulation?
I think we ought to apply a holistic approach to it. The forest fires last year dumped more carbon into the air than all the cars in California for a full year. Now, how stupid is it to raise the price of gasoline where middle-class families can't operate? At the same time, we ignore the management of the forests. We don't thin the forests. We don't build roads into them to allow equipment to get in there. And then we have a huge number of forest fires like we did last year, dumping huge amounts of carbon. Excuse the expression, but our politicians are missing the forest for the trees.
And some have said that one of the big problems is building too close to these forests, that we have unbridled growth and it's too dangerous for humans to build communities.
Well, that may mean that we should have a little bit more logging. And I think that's fine. You know, trees are a renewable resource. They actually grow, as you know. And logging companies are the ones who are most responsible. They want to make sure that they plant new forests and because they want to know 30, 40 years from now that they've got trees to harvest. So I think one of the big problems in California, too, is restricting logging.
As you well know, this is a largely Democratic state. We have a Democratic governor. Both of our senators are Democrats. The legislature is controlled by Democrats. California went over 60% for Hillary Clinton, even San Diego and Orange counties. So how do you think you're going to win in this state as a Republican?
Well, we've had Republican governors. Reagan, Duke Majian, who just passed, Wilson. Schwarzenegger was elected as a Republican. I think people are looking for a balance to this legislature. I think they're looking for somebody who is going to manage the state better. If you look at it, it's been very difficult for a Democrat to succeed another Democrat after 8 years because I think people want a change and they want better management. And I think that's why they'll look to make a change in 2018.
Even a Donald Trump-supporting Republican?
Well, I support what the president's been doing, cutting taxes, cutting regulations, staying up to North Korea and Iran. I have a different personality. I think a lot of it is based upon personality. People maybe just don't like the way he talks or something like that. But I like what he's done. I think this economy is going to break 3% this year. We're cutting regulations. We're getting people back to work. Black unemployment is at an all-time low. Hispanic unemployment is way low. I think those are good things, don't you?
John Cox, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
John Cox is a Republican gubernatorial candidate. The election is June 5th. And our conversations with the major candidates for governor continues tomorrow with another guy who says his experience in finance makes him the man for the job.
I have a record of finding money. You know, whether it's local governments using that money correctly, I was the state controller who audited Bell, right? They passed phony taxes. They didn't handle their bonds properly, right? They put their bond money into non-interest-bearing accounts. What a waste of taxpayer money. I'm the most successful auditor in California history. As a state controller, I did $9.5 billion of audit findings.
State Treasurer John Chung is here tomorrow on Press Play. And coming up on this program, our Legal Eagle is here to talk about legalized sports betting. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Too bad for Nevada. It will no longer dominate sports betting. The Supreme Court today said other states should be allowed to have sports betting if they want. New Jersey wants. It brought the suit, and it says it'll be ready within a few weeks to accept bets. It's Monday, so it's a good bet that Jessica Levinson is here to tell us everything we want to know about this. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle. Hello.
Hello, and now it'll be a legal bet as well.
I know, we just couldn't stay away from that. Okay, tell us about this case and why the court struck down this longstanding federal law which bans sports betting.
Well, this is a 1992 law, and as you said, it bans sports betting, but it's a little more detailed than that. It basically says states, you can't allow sports betting except for some states like Nevada that was grandfathered in, and Montana and Delaware and Oregon that had some limited sports betting. And so what the Supreme Court today said, with Justice Samuel Alito writing for the 6-3 majority, is this violates the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. And the 10th Amendment essentially says, if the Constitution doesn't give a certain power to the federal government and doesn't take it away from the states, then that power stays within the states. So what Justice Alito is saying is that Congress has basically stationed themselves in state legislatures and have said, we're just here to make sure that you don't allow sports gambling.
Which he said was unconstitutional. And did the other justices pretty much agree?
Well, five of the justices agreed with everything Justice Alito had to say. Three of the justices didn't agree and basically said there was a narrower way of reading this law so that it was still constitutional. But I think what's really fascinating about this case is that, on the other hand of the 10th Amendment argument, is something called federal supremacy. And this is a discussion that we had with respect to state sanctuary laws, legalization of marijuana, physician-assisted suicide, self-driving cars. So this certainly is a decision that has impact for gambling, which is a huge industry. There's a lot of practical impact. But in terms of the language of what the 10th Amendment provides, there's a big impact for other areas of the law, too.
Okay, so what does it mean for professional sports, though? Because a lot of the professional sports organizations were worried that if you allow widespread gambling, that that could corrupt the games.
Yeah, I think some organizations were worried about it, and certainly the federal government was worried about it. When I read the legislative history, it felt like a very kind of Americans in apple pie, and don't kind of besmirch our happiness and our sporting events by bringing gambling into it. But the truth is there's a huge illegal gambling market that already occurs to the tune of maybe $150 billion. And so I think what this means is that we will, states that choose to do so, will set up open markets for gambling. And now we don't know if that means only in person. We don't know if it means online. There's still a federal prohibition that basically says betting can't occur across state lines. So if there's going to be online gambling, you're going to have to make sure technologically that it doesn't cross state lines. And then there's always the possibility that Congress will say, you know what, we think we can do better. Thank you, Supreme Court. We can actually craft a legal law that basically just says, you know what, no sports betting across the United States of America. And thank you, Supreme Court, for the direction.
Well, as interesting as this case is, especially to you, there are other more important decisions that the court needs to weigh in on. And can you just briefly go over them and when we can expect to hear a decision?
Sure. So we will expect to hear decisions by the end of the term, which is usually the end of June. In this case, I believe it's June 29th is the last work day of the term. And so we have three different cases dealing with gerrymandering, how we draw district lines. There's two that deal with so-called partisan gerrymandering, one dealing with racial gerrymandering. There's a case that has very important implications dealing with whether or not a cake maker can say, you know what, I don't want to make a cake for gay couples. And so the next 6 weeks will be really busy, in part because we have never had so few decisions that have come out by this point in the Supreme Court term.
Hmm. Also, the president's travel ban, right?
Oh, right. There's a little thing called the president's travel ban. That is actually really interesting in light of today's case, because that does deal with issues of what is within the federal government's power. And it was, I think, argued on the last day of the term. So I would not expect to hear that until very close to July 4th. And then we can all either celebrate or, you know, throw it in the fireworks and set it on fire.
Okay. Speaking of setting things on fire, let's talk about Rudolph Giuliani. On Friday, the president's lawyer caused more headaches for the president's legal team. He told the Huffington Post that Trump himself denied AT&T's merger with Time Warner. That's CNN's parent company. No secret that Trump does not like CNN. But this contradicted months of statements by the White House insisting the president was not involved in the Justice Department's lawsuit to block the merger between Time Warner and AT&T. So therefore, what does that mean in terms of the viability of this legal action?
Well, I actually think it has more political implications than necessarily for the legal action. I mean, once again, it's Rudolph Giuliani, as you said, maybe not adding value to Trump's team. So in this case, the White House and the Department of Justice said Trump was never involved in this merger, even though candidate Trump really disliked the merger. Then Giuliani, in an effort to say when AT&T paid President Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, to try and influence President Trump, that they were so ineffective that actually President Trump did in fact put his thumb on the scale and denied the merger. I think that the issues here are, one, is Giuliani really just a dumpster fire at this point? And two, what is the issue with respect to political interference of the Department of Justice suing to block the merger?
But could that doom their case? The judge is supposed to decide this next month. Could the judge say, look, there's been some improper political interference. I'm not going to let you proceed with the suit to block the merger?
I think at this point, a judge would say we need to look further into whether or not there was improper political interference. I know that there was some discussion earlier in the case as to whether or not there could be discovery on issues related to whether or not there was any White House interference. So at the very most at this point, I think a judge would say, I need to hear more about it, and that could affect my decision.
And then Giuliani spent the weekend walking back those comments saying, oh, Trump didn't interfere after all with the lawsuit.
I think there should be a new term, like it's the Giuliani moonwalk, for walking back these comments. And that's exactly right. So what Giuliani has said, which is really troubling as a lawyer and frankly as a representative of the President of the United States is I know that I specifically said that, but I think everyone knows I didn't actually mean it. And what I really meant was you can't corrupt the precedent. What Giuliani really should have said is the president respects the independence of the Department of Justice. It's not his role to play in making these decisions, and therefore he played no role whatsoever.
Wow. Sounds like you would be a good advisor to the president.
Oh, no, I'm very happy as your legal eagle, but thank you.
Okay. Press Play's legal advisor, Jessica Levinson. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why a smiley face with the word "be" on it may be on your packaged food soon. It's supposed to designate food that's been genetically modified. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has come out with new labels for genetically modified foods. The labels don't actually say GMO or genetically modified. Some of them say just be, not as in be best, but as in bioengineered. And they look really happy, these images. Some of them look like smiley sun faces. They're not finalized yet. The labels are open for public comment until July 3rd. But here to kick off some public comment for us is Alan Bjerga. He covers food and agriculture for Bloomberg. Hey there.
Good afternoon.
Okay, so tell us what these labels look like. Can you just describe them for us?
So, yes, as you had said, they're little circles, and they're supposed to be prominent enough on a box of food that a person would notice them. But there are basically three choices that the rulemakers came up with. They all involve the word be, as you said, B-E for bioengineered, as opposed to, you know, just being, which would be a nice, healthy command for all of us to hear every day. But one would be sort of be with a leaf in a field in the backdrop, sort of agrarian. There's another one where it looks more like a sunburst. And then there's another one, the third choice, it's sort of a smiley face surrounded by bars. Now, you may wonder, how does this tell us that this has GMOs in it? Well, BE indeed does stand for bioengineered, which is a common term among scientists and folks in the industry, but not necessarily folks in the general public have heard. Presumably, they would be educated to know that bioengineered is what they understand as GMO. And of course, the logo itself doesn't really give a lot of information as far as which ingredients they are, how prominent those ingredients are. The idea is, of course, if you have a little scanner on your smartphone, you could get all of this in some voluntary industry effort. But yeah, the GMO label doesn't really tell you much, but it does say that it includes biotech products. That is the letter of the law. That is going to be part of this proposal that will be discussed until July.
Okay, and talk about the science behind it, because we have heard before that there is no scientific evidence that GMOs are dangerous to people's health, but yet there's a lot of fear about them out there.
And this was a big industry concern, which is when you start labeling for the presence of something, people start asking, why are you labeling this for the presence of something? What should we be concerned about? And of course, the industry position is there's nothing to be concerned about. And you're seeing this debate echo itself in some of the alternatives that the USDA put in its proposed rule, because this rule doesn't spell everything out. It actually gives commenters a little bit of leeway. For example, if you have to determine that something has GMOs in it, what is the threshold to say that the product has GMOs? A lot of folks in the organic industry and people have been pushing for a label want a very purist standard saying, look, if this has corn in it, and 90% of the corn in the United States is GMO, we can assume that this has GMO presence in it and it should have the label. On the other hand, you have folks from the high fructose corn syrup industry who are saying, look, you know, high fructose corn syrup is a highly processed product. It goes through several stages. Yeah, the corn may have been bioengineered, but really by the time you've gone through all the steps, there's no real difference between something that may have been from a non-GMO crop versus a GMO crop. So high fructose corn syrup shouldn't have this label on it. It's not a GMO product.
Okay, so where are they now then with that?
The proposal has come out. I mean, you can go to regulations.gov and you can make a comment on this. You can take a look at the whole proposed rule. You can see the smiley faces and leaves and bars all yourself. Decide which one you like, what you want to say. I guarantee you that your comment will be outnumbered by industry in the ratio of thousands to one. But they do like distinct and unique comments. If nothing else, the regulators get bored reading the same thing over and over again.
Okay, but it's more than just the label. It's what products are going to get the label put on them, right?
Yes, and there are a few little shortcuts that are being taken. For example, the USDA has said that, you know, there are certain crops in the U.S. that are almost entirely GMO now. If the product has that crop in it, it's going to be presumed biotech. And that's something that includes corn, soybeans, canola, cotton. And then there are some other products that don't necessarily have GMO varieties. Like, for example, there is no GMO wheat. So you're not going to see wheat bread with this label on it. Although you could, depending on whether that bread has high fructose corn syrup in it and what they decide to do with that. And of course, the industry sphere, once again, is because there's this label, now they're going to be pushed to make recipes that don't have biotech ingredients in this. And that is going to roll back the tide of GMOs that has helped their bottom lines.
Wow. All right. So I guess they're opposed. They wouldn't want one of these labels on their products.
Well, they did want the label to exist because, remember, this was all born out of lawsuits by states like Vermont and legislatures that were passing laws having state GMO labels. And this law was passed by Congress 2 years ago to head off a patchwork of standards. So the idea of having the label has been accepted by industry. But now, of course, the idea is to keep it as limited and as innocuous as possible because they don't want to make consumers afraid of their products. And frankly, they don't really want to change their products because it has this label on it.
So they like the label with the smiley face on it, I'm assuming.
I don't know if they like the label, one label more than another. I haven't really talked to them about it. But I can tell you that a lot of folks in industry are probably smiling about the outcome as far as how this labeling debate has turned out.
And do the American people really care about it?
You know, that really depends on what survey you're looking at. You know, there are surveys that have been put out by anti-GMO groups that say, you know, 80%, 90% of the population want some sort of a label. Well, people tend to always want more information when they're surveyed by something like this. When those questions are changed to have more specifics as far as what this would do, what this really means, those percentages go down. There's a very strong activist community that is very strongly opposed to genetically modified organisms and genetically modified crops. They've been very vocal. There are some folks who are very pro-industry and see any affront to this topic on biotech as a way to try to destroy the American farmer. The truth is always lies probably somewhere in that massive swath in between those two poles, and in that swath is where the American public stands.
Ellen Bjerga covers food and agriculture for Bloomberg. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, it's time for our genetically modified resident Norwegian. You are pure organic.
I am, completely. There's nothing wrong with my genes. DJ Simonet says of those new GMO labels, he thinks they're terrible. He says they should be like some flask and DNA helix being manipulated or something. He says the insinuation of these symbols implies healthy, natural, hell, organic stickers and logos look less healthy than these, he says. And Blade says, I don't really avoid GMOs, but I respect people's decisions to do so if they want. Anthony Williams says, the term GMO applies to a large amount of items. Some are bad while others aren't. Josh Shearer says, you can trust the science, believe there's nothing wrong with the concept of genetically modified foods, and still be wary of their current state for environmental, political, ethical, and anti-monopolistic reasons.
Mm.
I did put out a poll to see if people tried to avoid genetically modified foods. 11% said yes, they freak me out. 39% said sometimes, but I don't care that much. 43% said no, the science says they're safe. The fear is all misinformation. 7% said, what is a GMO?
Okay. A genetically modified organism.
Exactly.
Not a resident Norwegian. Thank you very much, Christian Bordahl. Sure. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.